This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Wow, it's letters before they ripened those formulations of 52, and I don't think there are any formulations for me since. At least technically, I don't think that I've developed since 54, 55. I admit publicly. However, I enjoy it, as they say. But I mean, you know, Dan, if the art was alive, then they really have to. You can't be hung up with the way they dance.
Any generalization I've ever been able to make about my own writing has always been
Let's take Burroughs. Well, Pound says somewhere that usually this thinking about the context and the actual act of it, that these usually proceed, as he puts it, like the feet of one biped. That you may get the theory ahead of the act, but usually it'll be a long
instant. Sometimes, now, for instance, in a workshop that Mike McClure was in, I explained to them that if it was possible in form and those things in Weber to have little short bits and then to make use of silence in between. And certain things seem to be happening in the very, very beginning. It wasn't called indeterminacy music in those days. They weren't even bothering about it, but I knew some things were happening in music or had heard reports of them. So I said, yes, it would be perfectly possible to open up an area of the poem. I mean, the notation, I knew how to do it. I was never able to feel a poem that way, and Mike McClure went off and wrote poems where I'd given the formula. So a formula that you might know, a thing you might know is possible, simply because you know something about notation and can see that this can be done,
proceeds.
Nothing I can do. I've never been able to make use of or feel myself what I think is a whole added area, and that is Charles's way of having discrete areas of the poem that really are almost like islands, and my inner margins always were margins still, and never were having floating areas, because I couldn't feel. I had to have old-fashioned continuum of image and now I'm even more thematic because there have been no technical developments to break up thematic composition.
Robert, you say that generally the breakthroughs turn back and kick.
Yeah, I think it's...
Because they're restricted. They're restricted to you.
You turn up, say, I'm saying...
Absolutely.
No, you're right. We didn't really kick the preceding school. Yeah, we didn't kick the preceding school. That's true. But nothing happened until I didn't look. I'm the one who was writing. It's always Bob writing in the period when that projecting verse thing hadn't come through. Now there are many other things that actually made. I had to write a certain way before I could even understand what the projective verse was talking about. I thought first it just meant that you read your poems aloud, and since we were all reading our poems aloud, I thought it meant we were doing fine. but when I had done certain things, I began to see, no, that isn't at all what this thing means. And as a matter of fact, I still have not, as I think I said last time, I still have not come to any conclusion of this. No, this is sort of an area between conversation. Any conclusion I have projected first, I go back to it, and find still challenges of what a poem might be that are beyond where
I think the danger for students, I think, would be to attempt to pick up a theory and write by it, even a theory that they think fits themselves.
But you see, I mean, it's don't view the theory, view it as propositions of writing, and then it's that motion. As for instance, the Chinese written character Fenollosa is still potent as proposition poetry, and Pound never carried out. It's still so open and so unexplored the implications of the propositions about verb and image.
Also says that Fenollosa was important in 1950, and that it was important then, and he feels now the emotions that when he transposed.
Well, but equally, he's speaking from having, in his case, he observed the whole. Look what happens to the syntax in Olson. And this is what he, if you want, not as an explanation, but as along with it, is this absorption of what Fenollosa was projecting. For example, when Williams first got word of the three rules of thumb that Olson suggests in that essay, he said it's as if the whole area lifted, and then he says everything in it leans on the verb. And in other words, everything is being returned to the context of act. Whereas poetry, again in the 40s, had become more and more supine. It was leaning on adjectives. It was leaning on nouns. It was leaning on idea structures. It was not there was almost no activity at all in a poem written, let's say, by people as Tate, Ransom, and all in that period. And Stevens, unhappily, was contributing to this as well.
Yes, by the poem Advancing Ideas. Well, Pound had a little gist that he sent out in 1948 that certainly anticipated what projected verse was, and that is the very first one. The instructions are given in the edition of the Venice poem. Those instructions of watch what is happening, the duration of vowels and tone leading of vowels and duration of syllables. Those three instructions. But to watch what is happening, I understood right away, meant you must watch and know what's happening in the poem. And what you think are your feelings and what you think are your ideas really are not the picture at all. It's what is happening in the poem. That's what they were doing in painting, too, was watching what's happening in the painting. Although many, so there's a real division in abstract expression between the ones who thought they were painting their feelings and the ones who were watching what was happening in the painting and what was the painting feeling. But I took that to watch. That really summed most of what then, and then what happened in projected verses, all of that turned into propositions that then proliferate as possibilities. Certainly, when you ask about kicking faith, I do think that Williams' mode is a primary mode. Williams is a primary mode in poetry. When he comes to the later stock, when he comes to the later mode, whereas most of us have specific personal styles and they're not usable as most. But I think that there, certainly Williams's three articulated line and the new development of a text schema in a way which is not by rhyme but by measure
of each
their identical words, but I mean not by repetition.
What actually is Williams's measure in the triplets?
Equivalent phrase groups in its
three. Yes, and they're thought of. It's what opened up the meaning of the march, and that you're able to have a movement that has
steps.
When you ask that question, when they ask about what in the world did Williams mean when he started talking about what it was, but you can have phrasing, and so that in reading you can come back to this margin. And these will all be lines. This is a whole line. But
it runs on, though.
Yes, but it's still...
What do you mean it runs on?
If it were read as someone talking, the natural force might not necessarily...
That is one thing I noted in reading Whitman, Howell, and Leidig, is that... No, you mean that the sentences aren't identical in lines?
No, the end of the emotional phrasing is not necessarily identical with the line.
You heard us all reading this book. When I read it, it is. This is emotional phrasing. Every one of these phrases is an emotional entity, and utterance can happen anywhere. As a matter of fact, a sentence may come here and a junction there.
Well, then Alan's
I heard Williams read this sort of speak on the down.
Yes,
down
but when you come to
primer,
a notation, a composer also can place his composition incorrectly.
Yeah.
Stevens, for instance, simply does not read in the rhythm that's in his lines, so the whole thing sounds rather dead. I was there. He has a very strong and vibrant rhythm that I've always found intoxicating, and then you turn on a record, and my God, it's like he never heard it. And there he is reading it aloud, and Williams often does not. Frankly, Williams developed something very, very, that was very, very suggestive, this business of using not a period, but something that might have pulled from and that I think is really usable in notation, and suggests right away an equivalence all around, and ambivalence of choice all around here that the voice has to do something with, and that also is like a... It's like a, if there could be something like a great pause that's there, and yet when he reads, he usually doesn't even try to cope with it, because I think the imagination moved out and proposed this, but reading-wise, Williams, after all, learned to read poems in 1900 or 1901 or 1902, and our strongest appetite. Well, why do we have to break the iambic pentameter? Because we were taught to read in an iambic pentameter, and can't even hear through it. And only by breaking it could you hear any of the phrasings in here. Bad enough that it went chug, 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 but good iambic pentameter poems didn't do that. But good iambic pentameter still left you with nothing but to learning how to read them by dreadful school getting you into...
What I'm trying to say is that I don't think Williams' triplets are done by any exact emotional science.
I don't think it's a science.
No, but I'm talking about an art, not a science. Yeah, I mean, but you can make them. If they're felt, they can make them by science. Science can turn around and measure each one of those and explain why the rhythm is one or two.
Yeah, I agree with...
No, I don't think that Williams would say that in other words, the cuttings are... of the phrasing, of the arrival.
But we're not worried about what we did when we took this, and all of us have used it.
I'm just trying to avoid somebody trying to, get hung up.
Well, have you read Tomlinson's appropriation of this time?
Yeah.
Because that's where you find you find something strangely gone out of it.
That's right, because you don't have the shifts. You don't have the shifts
in terms of emotion and parallel. And you don't have the... although Tomlinson has a very good ear, I mean, he's got a subtle and close ear, still the sense of coherence is primarily metrical. He's proposing, and he is weighing exactly according to syllable, and he's not sensitive to the duration of a syllable in different contexts. For example, if you say, if you're in some hurry, or if you're in a place... If you're shouting at someone to do something, then the emphasis of do will let that word exist for a shorter length than if you're more relaxed and saying, do you know, or something of that order. Well, Williams's ear was close to this kind of problem.
And so that one single word could stand could for, hold a, for a whole
yes,
portion
quite,
of
it. Especially through a double axis, one that it has the emotional nature of that order to hold for that time, as quote, feeling. And two, that it had the extensive possibility of sound. So that what I'm saying is, Robert says, I think, I don't find it interesting to see where it isn't always working in this order. But what I'm thinking of is this as a primary sense of how to organize. And as he was,
it opened up the possibility that you did not have to build up big over. This is just the opposite of building up big overwhelming emotions. You could change your mind, change your feeling, change everything in the course of that time. Compare the shift. Another poet who really shifts absolutely bewilderingly is Byron. But compare what happens between then compare how Byron shifts given the form he had and the form he developed in order to take care of them, and they had to have an irony. Yeah. Now, Williams doesn't have to have a thing to do with irony in order to have those turns. He didn't have to give a wry little smile because this is turned from something that has a humor and this has suddenly a fragment of something that is the sacred, and this may be a commonplace. He doesn't have to say, oh, watch me, or something. And he can if he wants to, because we know.
The ship should be turned inward upon, but I am an old man. But I am comes at the end. The ship should be turned inward upon, but I am an old man. All within one.
Or another instance where he says, give me time. Then he starts from time to time. These press flowers in the book, where you get the sense of time, as Charles was saying, apropos one of your poems, where beneath the water is used in two lines, and just the registration of it allows this phrase to take on an utterly new significance in a second.
One thing I just...
You can shift
on that. When I had David Moe, this is a convention, just like the sonnet form is.
Yep.
I mean, this is now a convention so totally taken over that academia has swallowed it, and we're part of the academia. What I meant by the mode was that it goes like the feeling of phrase and allows for many changes, and that we have not really thrown further out and into a new realm with what would move here. But
the dozen music is, to my mind, the key poem for this shift.
This is just like a sonata form.
Yeah.
And still playing in it.
And I find that the formal nature of the desert music is, to my mind, more interesting than any long work of Williams, including Patterson, insofar as it provides for a tremendously complex modality within a relatively small area.
Yeah, desert music disposes of all that hat rack business,
yeah,
and Patterson, the outline,
yeah,
and the
program,
yeah.
Yeah. The river business. But in any case, it seems that an inevitable reaction occurs against any such authority that proposes itself as such when you're starting to write. You have, as Robert says, one kicks one's immediate predecessors in the face in some sense. This is happening. I'm getting kicked in the face in a very pleasant manner, if this is possible, by a writer such as Robert Kelly, or Edward Dorn, for that matter. Dorn's line is very distinct. And his sense of material is very, very distinct. And he's bored and impatient with the kind of insistence that the people just before him have brought. Or rather, he jumps back to Olson as his instruction. And yet, if you read Dorn's poems, you'll find them that they're not. They don't look like Olson's, but that they're moving in reference to the same area of material. But anyhow, I mean, so I think what Robert's and I'm trying also to say is that imitation of the convention simply will take you into some knowledge of what that convention can do as a technique, but it probably won't provide you with any
release
of what you have to say.
Well, conventions at times always can yield new things.
Yeah, sure.
But it is.
But they should be recognized.
What a convention is should be recognized. You know, you're with it. An agreement with other thoughts about this as a form, as a convention, not an invented form.
Yeah.
So ideally, I think almost everybody's poetry will look totally different on a page, depending on their own physiology, their own breath, and
well, certainly
the
will
way
be.
They're thinking.
As witness Tomlinson's use of this convention, you get a totally different poem. Or I was thinking in when this form first came, a poem in this form was in Origin. And Sid Corman had a reply to it, which is very typical of Sid. And it was, and there you had Sid Corman in this convention. It was very, very, then you realized it was a convention because nothing happened to Sid. He was still Sid very much. And here he was just simply doing this dance. That's all.
I tried those.
Everybody
tried. 1953.
Yeah, I tried them too.
Did you ever publish it?
I got impatient, though. I couldn't stay in the convention. I mean by that, I wanted to jump around more than that. I don't think I did. But I found that you could start off, and it was like heroic couplets. You could go on and on and on and on. It was great. If I ever write a quote long poem, I may use this convention. It has everything to do with
poems. Who made the phonemic process?
What is
the phonemic word?
Laws or laws?
Clause.
Who mentions that? Phonemic.
See, now, if I really do say the strangest thing.
Why should it be a clause? I mean,
what is phonemic?
Really came
mean?
Out
you know
of my mouth like that?
No.
came out of his mouth.
No.
Well, it's an expression the linguists have come up with, yeah, as nearly as I can understand.
Oh, yeah.
They mean the same thing that Olson means when he says the breath measure. They're talking about a foot, what Williams called, I guess, a variable foot. And he means the group of syllables, no matter how many, it has one major stress.
Yeah, and that's called utterance, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because they call it an utterance. It's when they try, they're trying to make an American grammar at the present point, and they discover they could not use as a linguistic entity what they used to call a sentence, because it makes no linguistic sense at all. You have to listen to what people are saying. See, our written language and it has inventions, and among its many inventions is the sense. But also, the other thing is, the American language, and I suppose this would certainly be true of Canadian too, is increasingly going toward a stutter. If I thought I had a weird stutter, in order to write this work on the sentence, they got permission to tape the telephone conversations of the members of the English department, the professors in the English department at the University of Minnesota or wherever it was they were doing the study, and they transcribed them. And it was that that told them, not listening to any of us stuttering, that the shortest sentence they got went something like, which they transcribed beautifully, but the only way they could describe a sentence then was that it had a major juncture, and then they discovered a principle in it, and that was, and that's American, not British, that it has one major stress, and around that are grouped, and this seems to govern how long an utterance a person can make, around that are grouped any number of three or four other stresses, degrees of stress.
Are you going that route? Well, I might.
They make this point about it. They're talking about the isochronal values of this foot or breath measure of phonemic clause. They say this, assuming it has one major stress, assuming that it has a terminal juncture, it doesn't have to be a major one like a sentence has.
So that's a clause. That's Jimmy clause, isn't that sense.
Assuming that you don't have an emotional or kinesthetic change of correlative values in the phonemic clauses, every phonemic clause will take the same length of time to read.
I see, too. That's too bad. That is...
Yeah,
I
have been talking
about it. Right. It's important to reiterate that in under ordinary circumstances, this is that is... If there's not a violent change in the order, not a real change in the emotion, but then the person in this form, in this business, is a change in emotion all the time, isn't there? I mean, that's part of what the phrasing makes possible.
Does that get it clear enough? Yeah.
Everybody does that intuitively, more or less, or with different
vocabulary. Well, they just happen to do it. Now, the measurement comes, you see, and this kind of measurement comes after the fact. Now, an invention comes before the fact. The difference between an invention... I mean, a proposition, a formula for something that can be done is very different from observing what has been done. And what you're calling science is, or what you think evidently our remarks about poetry are, we make remarks, propositions of what poetry can be, whether we do it or not. That's why that great big open, do you write projective verse? No, this is a proposition of possibilities, and was it ever written or done? Who knows? I mean, that's why it's still alive. And when it has been done, nobody's going to be interested in it. I mean, then it'll fall back into this conventional thing. It's a very simple convention to describe. What's interesting is that Williams never seems to have been acquainted at all with the work that, nor the linguists weren't acquainted with Williams. So.
No, Williams used the word unsufferness.
Yes, but that comes from different sources. That isn't that. It just simply means the same time. I just mean that he wasn't drawing upon the linguistic studies. They really came so late in his life. He kept whenever he talked about measure, he really was fumbling. He kept trying to do that for measure, and knowing no, it couldn't work. And when Ivor Winters used at least two stresses or three stresses for Williams, he said, "I can't make out what he's doing." When actually it was the real secret of what this was. The fact that there were more than that stresses. Winters at least knew he at least was canny enough. At that early point, it was early, it was in the 30s, and everybody thought, where in the world did he find that? They'd only have to look around, that's how anybody records language.
What's useful, if Traeger's, what's useful for this?
Well, just for the notation is Traeger and Smith. Traeger. But I think they've got a new, Traeger has a new, doesn't Traeger have a new enlarged thing on now for linguistic classes that it's not Smith any longer? But it's...
No, we
But any linguistic class giving you the description of American language, and I can't remember the name of the man of his book on the sentence. That's what you really find.
What about Christine Rose? Is she any good?
She's the best. According to the language, she's the best book I've met before.
Oh. Well, it's a funny territory.
Well, I think Sapir and...
I think just this measurement stuff is the thing to talk about there, because when they turn around and start putting on like they're going to talk about something like metaphors, they don't know if they're asking a hollow ground.
Yeah,
you've
that's
got a very clear description of either one.
It's light.
Pardon?
Where would I put, pardon? Worf, B.L. Worf?
Worf. Well, Worf really does. I think Worf has the first structural idea. He hit stronger poetry. Worf's in a different, put him in a different class than Prager, because Prager's just a man who does measurements. Worf is a real, like Sapir is a real imagination in the world of linguistics. They have had a couple of...
Triggers with the measurements you speak.
They're just measurements, and they give you notation, which is quite usable, and you can then turn around and measure something you've done to find out what is going on under it, and just throw up in a diagram. That's all it is. It's not anything else.
These are easily available. But they're helpful. I mean, I found all of these people helpful simply to reassure me that what I was feeling about this organization of language wasn't simply, I wasn't making it out of whole cloth. So I found it useful. It didn't then and there help me to write anything, but it helped me to think about it.
So it's understood that this is no help in writing.
Or maybe, but it may
well, Warp and Zapier is a great help because it really opens your mind.
It comes in like as Penalosa again.
And I do not understand why the mechanics wouldn't be a help in writing, since if it is not surely self-expression, if it's comparable, let's say, to the kind of craft that goes into making a chair, making a building, making anything, if it's pulling, then mechanics is damn important, and you have to concern yourself with it. But the thing is, there are other things the poem is. And in the tradition of the bard, or in the tradition of speaking with voices, this business of making things even seem wrong. We are talking about a poem this morning.
Yeah.
Something made work.
Well, for example,
did I say it before in here that, for instance, the Hasidic masters felt that the prohibition in the Bible against a graven image meant you should not have anything to do with the poem at all. The point. And we're talking right now about the poem. The thing is that is the thing was specifically against. And they said you should pour the poem out from your heart. But this other thing is to build the heart into the statue like the coin does, and the thing contained in its box or its jar that you make. We're talking about the mummified heart. Recollected in tranquility, it's a little jar containing something like that. Two guys. Then get the car better and better, you know, later, so people don't know how to do it. And the heart's from there. And like in the Bible, they tell us it's always being a living person, but we're talking about a point in that poem. And then all that nature is true.
Yeah. I think so.
I don't think it was that necessary. I mean, it's a question not of symbolizing something, but of making a notation so that the voice can read it and approximate if you really can read and read it and are interested in reading the notation. get the movement of the poem. I found it, notationally I found a curious idea of this, what I take as a very confusing indeed, because that's in a way it's felt. It's a reoccurring experience now. Well, I suppose it reoccurs, but it isn't felt like a pivot down the middle.
It helped a little
bit. One thing that made very difficult opening up areas of the poem, opening up the poem is what it did. It's just crazy. So it had to come out of color, you couldn't change it or other.
So what I did. I tried to determine what it was when it was doing, what this book was. And I finally, after seeing my questions and people, and touching on Shakespeare's, and talking about normal speech being broken up into these particular things, and having these groups of syllables, which I think all of them in class, being grouped together in this isochronous relation, I set up this notation that would take us into consideration and notate it on the page. So that instead of putting 1, 2, 3 this way, I put them on each other and line them up so that the major stress came.
I think that in Lee's poem, a little more grace is allowed for the reader in that where that stress is then variable and open. We know there's one in each phrase, but the shifting is almost the personal feel of the rhythm as we go through.
It might not be a single word that has the stress. It might be, divided down.
No, it's a single syllable that has the major stress.
William says that he did not find any consistency, or he said, when I asked him, he did not find absolute consistency in that. It was just
variable, but in each phrase it would be a major stress.
Not one single word.
What you just said there, you just illustrated the point there. You put the stress on each one. You said, what you said.
Well, you'll be making a mistake if you do. Because the point the stress is sometimes just like a floating stress, like half and half. In one
word,
one part of the triplet, you might have like a sort of
bananas
under, and two of them will together will be sound like one note. It might not be located in one single word in the collection of words there.
What do you mean isn't located in a single word?
Well, he means
stress over more than one syllable. I mean, a given stress, I don't think.
Well, yes, then it would be a mistake to think in terms of stress then.
No, because it's a stress pattern that's forming.
It is
definitely, as anybody composing music has patterns of stresses and that they can compose with. That's why you don't have to rhyme literally. You can have rhymes of stress patterns.
I think that Lyon was using very carefully this thing of stress, where the major stress goes. And I think Williams knew when he spoke of a variable foot. I think he had it instinctively, but I don't think it was ever articulated by him
as
the way that Olson did later when he spoke of the resonance.
That's true.
That's right. For instance, Williams was first perfectly capable of saying that poets nowadays didn't have measure. Well, this is like saying rooms don't have measure. In a way, it meant something. It meant that poets weren't dealing with measure. You could say this architect had no feeling of measure when he made this room. But every room really has a measure, which you can measure, and every single phrase does have. That's why it's a matter of not paying attention. That's why we feel it so immediately when somebody's insensitive to the measurements in something, because there is measure there, and there is not. There's not really elegance, grace, or any of the other things that we might feel, or roughness, all the various things we can feel because there's been a conscious and careful engagement at the level of the measure. And the only way to have that engagement decently is to know right in your hands again, like a person making a really fine piece of furniture, is to have the mechanics. But we did discuss the fact that periods want to throw the mechanics away, and then you have a disappearance of the art. You have furniture that's so badly made it falls apart, but it's terribly expressive when it's done.
I don't agree with that. I think you cannot make it a science again.
Is it a science when a man makes a fine piece of furniture with fine fittings, knows how to make the fittings, knows how to knows the proportions and and we see everywhere the shaping of hand.
Is it an art?
This is a craft, but it's also the involvement of the total person in the thing made.
Yeah,
we're not describing irregularity.
Let's keep it in the context of the sense of all of this as propositions. We're not imposing these upon anyone as laws. We're simply trying to say what can be observed in the action of language in the poem. That's all.
Phonemic
clauses occur. Williams' senses of duration occur. How much time? What the relation of the time is to the stress? What the relation of the time is of stress is to the movement of the emotion? What the kind? I mean, these are simply ways of understanding more particularly what it is we're doing. I mean, I do not...
On a very simple thing. Yeah. My difficulty was I thought that what was being said is that each one of these would have one syllable which had a major stress around which the other stresses were grouped and clustered.
That is usually the case.
That is not my that's not my observation, Williams, and I asked him about it, and he said that's not his observation either, really. But there's one single syllable that carries the major stress for each one of the triads.
It seems to me that there is
his measurement there was sometimes just the weight of idea of the whole phrase compared with the weight of idea or feel of the other. So that, in other words, the measurement could not be located or defined as being a single syllable which has one stress.
Yeah, Alan, that seems to me simply coming at it in another direction, arriving at the same effect.
This was not a formulation originally. Formulation about the single stress is that it has to do with speech, not with poetry, because you can depart from it. This is a description of all American speech taken anywhere in any event that we all share.
In each single breath, one word which carries the main weight?
One syllable.
Well, what about one word which carries the main weight?
Then the syllable will probably
be the word. Then every kind of weight can go around it.
That's the point. Every kind of weight does go around. That's what gives it the variability.
We didn't say it was a variable, but we said there was
there's a point where this variability...
Are you saying that one word is louder than all the rest?
Not louder, not worse.
Size more.
What's the emphasis?
There seems to be, in this, taking any context of language in terms of American speech habits, there appears to be an organization as clusters, each of which cluster seems to have one marked stress, that is one stress given more weight than other stresses, upon one syllable appearing in that cluster.
We have the difficulty of describing something without noticing something there to describe.
It says that, wait a minute. We were, after all, trying to think of how poems could be written against the context of all the metrical accumulation up to, say, 1945. This is not, you're quite right, now you're kicking, and usefully. This is no longer your battle, but it was certainly our battle in the 40s and 50s. Because we were trying to think of how a poem could be written, just as William said, how am I going to get "I kick your eye" into the poem? Now that had no, there was no metrical context for that to occur. Absolutely. We can now define why it does. This is useful to know simply for literal, quote, reassurance, unquote. So that this, fellow, someone says to you, that's not iambic pentameter, you can now tell him he's full of bullshit. I mean, this has nothing to do with the organization. In other words, it's simply as a
practical thing I've been operating on is that each breath unit spoken is discrete and completely different, and it's a little variable universe within itself.
Now, this may or may not be true.
Yes. That's the proposition I'm advancing.
Yeah.
So that, in a sense, there can be no measure in terms of the equivalence by number of, you're saying, one stress compared in this group will compare to one stress in that group.
But the point is that even beyond that, the point is that if you write syllabic verse, for example, if you write upon the organization of syllables, just one, and count them, quantitative, so on, mm-hmm. you do get one kind of texture. I mean, you do. It's
no, this is as simple as the music having a beat. Yeah,
that's all.
And how far can you go when you realize that you do not have to set up a steady beat in order to have a rhythm? You can have great postponements of recurrence of a beat.
For example, listening back in the 40s to musicians like Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, what I found interesting was that within the length of the rhythm of the duration, that is the length of the duration, or the length of the unit of duration, they were able to vary the rhythmic term so as to create a sense of longer or shorter time. Now this was very interesting to me, although they never, I realized, got away from the rhythmic coherence that was extending throughout the piece.
Ornette Coleman did finally apparently break out of that. I mean, he moved on to...
Yeah, he began to play as discrete... His organization became a sequence of discrete...
Ornette Coleman. And I think that was a real... Technically, that was a real interesting thing. Well, see, then, poetry also.
Of course, yeah.
Because that puts us way out in space.
Well, it puts us back with Alexander Pope, in a curious way. Who also did it, yeah. He did it with his thinking, but not with his rhythm. What found again, verse consists of a constant and a variant. This is what he gave as a definition of verse once. Mm-hmm. And it's as good as I can think of.
Yeah.
But I've seen a rhythm.
Well, I guess the only thing I'm objecting to is that I feel that the preconception of a constant or of a measure still, I think, impedes the emergence of an actual measure which will come out organically during the process of writing in any case. And I keep, the only reason I'm making all these objections is that I keep being afraid.
I want to ask
you. Do you object to entirely invented rhythms, I say, like mine, which don't come out au naturel, but
I want to ask, remember, Robert,
the students will search for a...
No, wait, we must make a distinction between what we're thinking about and what we're doing. To this extent, I remember once asking you about rhyme, and you outlined for me very quickly, as it was, about at least, I think, 8 to 10 distinct kinds of rhyme.
Well, I think tone leading is more important than rhyme.
Yeah.
I mean,
because
rhyme is very crude
but
compared
I,
with actually using the vowel tones.
Yeah, literally. I was confused simply having come from the sense of academic training. I was confused because I had never heard rhymes the way that it was proposed to me. And I remember asking, and then you finished by saying, this is what one can know about the thing, but of course no one in writing actually is thinking of rhyme in this way if he's coming to an actual organization of language. He's not stopping to think, what is the full rhyme here or what is the half rhyme? A poem written with that consciousness would be obtrusive. I mean, that is, that consciousness would be obtrusive.
Back to the mechanics. One thing mechanics opened up was the linguist would be aware you couldn't have an unstressed. You could never have an unstressed syllable because if it was unstressed, you wouldn't hear it at all. And so that they, I think it's 5, isn't it? I mean, it's all on elevator operator. It's an elevator operator and so forth as it goes. But I think it's 5 stresses. This was, if you have 5 stresses that you actually could compose with, this is so much more than only listening to a beat. I mean, that's exactly the drag of one beat stuff in music compared with any open composition. Yeah.
Bob's poem, The Court Guard, completely depends upon, as I found out, upon the variation of the secondary.
And it changes the pitch that you can introduce with...
Or how else would you understand something like Olson's line, she who's burned more than half her body skipped out of death, one line, observing, second line. Now, how else would you speak of that if you don't bring into some kind of attention?
Well, how do you parse that? Or how do you...
I think that that first line is a beautiful instance of this isochronous, or this phonemic clause.
Yeah.
She who was turned more than half her body skipped out of death.
Uh-huh.
Now, actually, I would feel that the stress there is the variable foot that Williams mentions. Easily you can determine it. You can put it in many places.
Yeah.
But that, to me, has the duration of what then occurs observing.
Corso says that he measures his lines by each one being a discrete, his word for isochronous.
Listen to radio announcers, for example. You hear they speak in artificial phonemic clauses. And they're trying to. Yeah.
I don't understand what this is. Remember, Simon said he could stack something, but Alan said it was all stress.
No.
So each one of those stresses, they're all stress, all stress.
We have a lot of short. We have a lot of short clauses this time. Out is one.
Yeah.
Well, that's complex. It's not one single.
It's double. Good point. Pardon?
Yes. William used a single word as a complete.
Yeah. It's.
However, if you started looking for stresses and attempting to break your lines up according to that, you'd wind up with an awful stuttery thing, I think.
But I also think it isn't arbitrary. I mean, couldn't I just change that sentence that I gave?
Yeah.
Yes.
Change it up
a little. Oh, yeah.
You can use the.
But were your opportunity to articulate it in the particular manner that you wish is possible is in the writing of a poem. There.
It's not a fixed sign.
Absolutely not. No one has ever suggested that it was. It's saying. Change it.
Okay.
The point is, it's like, otherwise you're getting into a car that always goes 30 miles an hour. You know, always. Well, true.
The use of all this whole thing is purely descriptive, and it comes after the thing's been done.
But
but
isn't it of some use to realize that that change has occurred, for example, that you're not 5 years old? Isn't it of some use to you to be aware of the fact that the change has occurred? Well, your clothing describes me.
Well, the minute I become aware of the change has occurred, I get hung up on abstracting and generalizing about the change, as I have been about feeling the last couple of weeks.
Well, I take. No, my nature is such that I'm led to that we must understand what is happening. And that the attention is for me given to what's occurring as I write. This is not a. I realize that this is perhaps or can occur as a self-conscious prevention of what otherwise is possible. But equally, I know that when something is happening, I'm my attention is more interested in that than it is in.
Now I wonder what skills are involved.
No, there's double
what
walking.
What are the skills? No.
Well, all the little shrewd ideas that we all know, technically, like isochronous poetry, are there while you're writing. You're aware of them, and you're using them. But, I mean, that, sort of like they're sort of little side hands helping and putting everything in place.
Well, take a carpenter or man building a bricklayer or something.
Someone, let's say, who has no consciousness of these techniques and one who has.
Well, okay. Now, what if leaving the word alone? Mm-hmm. How much craft was he putting into that when he did it?
No, I don't think he's talking about this at all. That is a pretty.
When he made his
very,
line.
Very direct, primitive poem.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about poem where the skill enters in, which is another part of the art.
Well, Shakespeare.
The thing that I felt was like Marshall. Looking at what Marshall did in spreading his mind out on the page turned me on to a whole technique which I used later in college.
Yeah. Well, see, you did it.
Directly out of that.
You did it. You said to me, I'm using an Edward Marshall line.
Yes.
Here.
And I went and knelt at Marshall's feet.
You naughty boy.
Taught me how to write. But what
you're not telling them not to read that.
No, but what it was that he taught me was that he didn't have to worry any longer about where to place the line on the page.
We're not talking about worrying, we're talking about knowing, which is it.
Which is what you know.
Well, what he taught me was that I didn't have to know. He told me, no, this is a real simple thing.
I know.
The point was he freed me
from that concern.
From conceptions of craft.
Well, you asked a very pointed question. I think if you could straighten something out, maybe.
No.
What is the difference between the poem where this information is used knowledgeably or consciously and the poem where it isn't? We could say this.
Well, wait, sorry, just not to interrupt, but just to say, my sense is these skills are absorbed in the actual, well, for example, I'm trying to think of an instance where it's clear. Take someone driving at the Mille Miglia or someone where the whole skill of driving is now automatic, has been absorbed to the point where it's automatic. Someone playing tennis, for example, is not thinking, I hold the racket like this in order, that is absorbed, isn't, he knows that. But you know damn well if he gets on the court with someone who simply picks up the tennis racket and says, let's play tennis, and has never literally thought about how you might play this game, that he's going to be slaughtered. There's no such thing as a natural tennis player. There are such things as natural poets.
If you were to figure out each muscle, you'd be sort of lost about the role of walking at all.
I know.
But if you're the thing where I think it's of value to work consciously with it is, and I would say you can release this yourself without this. But then you've got the problem of
reading
your reader see it your way, and if you lay it out on the paper with some deliberation, you know, you've got some chance that he'll at least read it the way you intended.
Well, I think it's a big mistake to do that.
That's not part of my picture, because I think nobody ever really thinks about how to read Howell, which is right there. That it isn't how the reader's going to get the way you read it. It is whether you do want to do it this way. Whether you get a pleasure at being skilled father at it. But this is, you know, it doesn't make the difference between one poem and a better poem. We're not talking about that. There could not be, if we're going to talk about a good poem, there couldn't be a gooder poem than a Marshall's, but it's a primitive poem. And in the area in which a person takes delight in skills, then these things enter in. Now, Alan, obviously, from what he says, feels a real interference with the feeling of the poem if any think goes on, I suppose. But I don't have any think. I have an organic brain that likes to take pleasure in working with things. And I've got to have certain skills. I mean, I want to hear more. I want to use more tones, more complex and complex.
I was astounded.
That's what I'm talking about.
I was astounded at Marshall's skill in notation of his actual mind. Moving.
Yeah.
That was a skill there for me. And in that sense, not primitive at all, but you know, very highly sophisticated. You had to get through an awful lot of it.
He'd got this, as far as I can remember. I think he had got this by reading Williams and Olson.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, he was not illiterate. I mean,
I'm not saying he's illiterate. When a tennis player is instructed, how do you hold the racket, it's not because there is a special formula, it's because it fits best that way. Organically, it fits best that way.
That's what we were trying to do with these propositions about senses of poetry in the 50s. We were trying to say it fits best that way, that the sonnet or that the iambic pentameter does not provide a mode in which the words fit or have this feeling of possibility. In other words, it's like trying to play tennis in armor or something. Yeah.
Hey, Robert, you know that thing you were asking about Charles and Lyon observing?
Observing,
yeah. Observing. Now, this to me is sort of like a histological statement of the transference.
I don't. What is this?
What's histological mean?
What is histological? What?
I mean, it's a statement, virtually. Now, look, this is what I'm doing, champ. I'm looking at this chick from a moment.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, it has that aspect, sure.
Yeah.
Because, I mean...
I don't think it has an aspect. I think that's precisely what it is.
I'm trying to make it a science or something?
Of that woman's condition or state to him in his state, and he states both of them.
Well, it might be very well that he didn't know what else to say after he said observing,
look,
so he just left it there.
Language has existence as sound, as rhythm, and as semantics or as meaning. Now, you can take the point of view from any one of these positions. In other words, you can take your sight from any of these positions and have a relationship occur with the words as you read them. But we were speaking about the phonemic and rhythmic aspects of poetry. So that now, I mean, I think, John, if we take it into the semantics or into the whole position and relationship of meaning, that we'll really get into deep water if you don't even have a text for it. You know.
Precisely, why don't you want to go to semantics to figure out what Charles means when he says one thing about the woman and says observer?
Well, you're talking semantics now. Semantics is the study of meaning, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's not meaning. There's no meaning there. He is giving a statement of condition.
You're giving me the meaning, John.
Let's not get hung up.
John, I can't follow it anymore, even.
Yeah.
You're telling me what it means, you see? It doesn't matter if you call it Band-Aids or something, or cabbages, but it, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
Dumoulin went up at speed and Caracciolo was going
down.
And got nearly killed.
Yeah. Well, this knowledge of what to do when you go through a bridge at this speed is part of the craft, my sense.
I mean, Alan's quite right about one thing. You really have to be a deal maker to feel the way what you're writing goes, you know.
Yeah.
The knowledge, say, is going on.
Well, I have to feel the way those lines are going, but what I meant was that if you really want to bring all your faculties into play and have a pleasure there, and so then you want the feeling in every kind of way, then you begin to be interested in also seeing at this level. It's a business of how many levels of your observation and of your knowledge can come into play while you're dancing. Well, now, there's some people, if they knew what their feet were doing, would just begin to stumble right away. Whereas if they didn't know, they could dance better than you could ever make. I mean, you photograph it on and on and try to say, how did that ever happen? But the other thing that happens once you know that business is that you begin to have ideas of what can happen here that's going to change the dance, or else you're just waltzing the rest of your life because you learned 1, 2, 3. And it doesn't make any difference whether you learn 1, 2, 3 or you learn going sentences like this. It's only when you can make an observation at that technical level and they really give them a nice notation for it. I mean, I do think, but you could stop. Music's been terrifically stopped by notation because it also meant they could see so concretely what they were doing that they lost the little variation of hearing how different this was every time they performed it. And it went on and on and on until modern music tried to erase variations in performance. In the beginning, notation never hung anybody up about the fact that every time I read these lines, they're different. So this part, I agree with you. I mean, if you looked at that notation and then even tried to read poems and make every one of those notation marks, would not, even if it were the finest one for the first reading, it should never prevent all the alternatives and variable readings of the notation of the thing, or else it would really be quite dead. It would just be the repetition of a record.
Well, isn't this what Steckbus does,
Yeah, that's what I said. It made it. But
what
I think it did less variable than the open line.
I think it did usefully for Lionel, which is really the point. Is it helped him to locate how this was true. In other words, it helped him to find for himself how it was that Williams had organization in this sense. I mean, how this was occurring.
But isn't Lionel going to get hung up when he comes to read it?
I don't think.
No, it works. When I read it, it works.
Now you can throw it away.
Yeah, I think your point that other people coming to them shouldn't be forced to read them this way is a valid point.
Sure.
I'm not sure what I'm getting at. Except that I keep feeling the one thing that seems to be lacking in a lot of the writing I see is sincerity with the words, in the sense of saying something sincerely, uttering something with enjoyment of the sound of the words and the awe of the words, is being supplanted by attempting to arrange fragments of words so that it will look impressive to someone else. And part of this attempt at arrangement of impressive fragments is generally like an excessive mental concern, excessive intellectual concern with.
It's just a thought of what other people are going to think. People can also have big emotions that are impressive to other people. And I mean,
I'd rather die my emotions than. I could finally put one.
Then, if we write off, why should we write off any of the possibilities? I was thinking of Boulez. Why should I say that Boulez is simply an attempt to arrange impressive fragments? Yeah. And this is the discrete order. Why should we try to keep closing the doors instead of perhaps opening them? I think let's let it sit. Yeah. Let's see.